Well, good morning, church. How are you this morning? Thank you for the invitation to participate this week in your event that you're hosting on the character of God and on nonviolent atonement. I want to share with you this morning a little bit of my story. My story begins when I was 4 years of age. How many of you can remember? You have a memory from when you were 4 years of age. You can go back that far. I know for some of you it's harder than others, but how about three? Can you go back as far as three? Anybody go back as far as two? All right, it's getting harder. How many can go back as far as 1 year old? You have a memory from when you were one. Yeah, there's usually only one person in the room that raises their hand at that stage. My earliest memory is when I was 4 years of age. I was seated in one of those 1970s metal high chairs. How many remember those with the stainless steel tray that clamped down on the top? None of this safe plastic like they have today. There was two metal rods that you could protruded off the either side. You could impale yourself on as a small child. And when that tray clamped into place, does anyone remember the sound that that tray made when it clamped into place? Anybody? You could have been raised in an atheist home and you still prayed to whatever was out there that there were no body parts near that sucker when it went off. And I was seated there, 4 years of age, stainless steel tray. And seated on this stainless steel tray was one of those puke green Tupperware bowls of the 70s. Anyone remember those? Anybody still have some of those? Yeah, go home, throw those away. In my puke green Tupperware bowl was my favorite breakfast cereal of all time, still my favorite breakfast cereal to this day. Anyone want to guess what it is? See, you're Adventist. Adventists always say Cheerios. You can connect the dots. You're so healthy. No! My favorite breakfast cereal as a child was Fruit Loops. Loved Fruit Loops. And there I was, seated, eating my Fruit Loops, and my father was standing to my right, and my mother was standing to my left. And does anyone want to guess what was transpiring between them? Oh, you have parents too. Yes. It was a discussion of such intensity that it lodged itself in my four-year-old heart and mind as my first memory in life. It wiped out everything before that. Ironically, that's the only memory I have of my parents while they were still married. My folks, before I could turn five, went through what many couples do today. They became separated and then divorced. Anyone here come from a split home by chance? Anyone here? You'll be able to identify with a little bit of what I'm about to share. Overnight, I found myself being raised by a single mother in the late 70s in West Virginia. Anyone ever been to West Virginia? I know it's Southern California, but we are all the time economically challenged, but in the late 70s, we were especially economically challenged, and my mother worked long hours. Many times, what we ate for dinner at night depended on how much she made in tips during the day. Anyone want to guess what she did, since I just gave you a clue? Waitress, that's always, yes, it's a good guess. What other occupations make tips? And I said during the day, so yes. She was a hairdresser, that's right. She cut hair. Matter of fact, I'll tell you a little secret. Before we became Adventists, we moved. Oh, this is being live streamed. Well, that's not a secret. We lived in Charlotte, North Carolina. My folks, my mom and my stepdad by that time became enamored by PTL. Anyone remember that as back in the 80s, early 80s, PTL, Jim and Tammy Baker? We moved to their ministry and my mom used to cut Tammy Faye's hair. True story. Never did her makeup, but did cut her hair. That was my first introduction to Christianity, by the way. That was a wild trip. But there we were in the late 70s, mom just trying to, but this was before she got remarried, just trying to make ends meet. She would drop me off early in the morning at my aunt's house, be in my blue Superman pajamas with the feet sewn into them. Anybody still got pajamas with feet sewn into them, slide across the hardwood floors? By the time she picked me up in the evening, I was back in my pajamas once again. My mother worked such long hours, I don't think she ever saw me in normal clothing for quite a few months. And the time I got with my mother was very limited, but it was special. My mom and I became best friends. It was her and I against the world. I'm proud to be raised by a single mom. She's no longer with us, but I'm proud to be to have been raised by the incredible woman that she was. Growing up with my mother, you have to understand, in West Virginia, our towns aren't very big either. I grew up in a town, and this is going to be hard for you to identify with because of where you live, but the population of our town still today is only 3,000 people. That's a whole town. The streets in a town that size aren't very long. Matter of fact, this is a true story, no exaggeration. I grew up on the same street that my father also lived on. We were only 20 houses away. Are you with me? I passed his house every day on the way to school. I passed his house every day on the way home from school. And I grew up always hearing about how he had abandoned us for another woman. How he refused to pay child support. 20 houses away, and my birthday would come and go. And not so much as even a birthday card to say, "Happy birthday, son, thinking of you, hope you're doing well." 20 houses away. When I turned 14, I decided I was going to go meet my father for the very first time. That was a trip. Have you ever had something where you didn't really want to do it, but you felt like you should do it, so you did it anyway, kind of a compulsory nature? Hopefully this morning is not one of those events for any of you. But I went to go visit my dad, and I remember standing in his kitchen, and his wife, my stepmother, looked at me and said, "You know, Herb, your father really loves you and wishes you'd visit more often." Love? Shoot, what Dad needs for his birthday is a Webster's Dictionary. I could define for him what love is, and this has not been it. But I continued to go back and visit. Then I turned 16. And something happened that would change the course of the rest of my days. There's only three things that can happen when you're 16 that'll change the rest of your life. Anyone want to guess what it was? Yeah, it's either a driver's license, and I did get one of those at age 16, and it changed the rest of my parents' life. You either meet someone special, or you fall in love with Jesus. Those are like the big three at sweet 16. Well, mine was I met the woman of my dreams, and I knew the first moment I saw her, this is the girl that I'm going to spend the rest of my life with. And some of you are thinking, how did you know that when you were just 16? Is there anybody here that's ever been 16 before? Yeah, and what did you know when you were 16? Everything. That's right. The ironic thing is that she knew from the first moment she saw me, she knew the exact same thing, that I wanted to marry her, that is. And so she kept me at arm's distance until we were about 18 or 19 and we began to be just friends. Anyone know what that means? Everyone else sees it. You're still living in denial. What's going on with you and so-and-so? Oh, we're just friends. That's right. Then things began to get even more serious. We had both left in the East Coast and come out here to California. She was successfully going to school down here in Southern California, and I was in Northern California giving it my honest effort. And halfway through that school year, I decided, I was 19 years of age, I decided I'm wasting my life. My life is just going past me too quick. You remember those feelings of anxiety about your future at age 19? And how many wish you could just go back and relax a little bit? I said, I'm going to ask her to marry me. And so I'd never been to Central California. I just looked on the map, Monterey Bay. I know some people there. There's a little place on the map there called Lover's Point. That sounds like the perfect place to propose on a map. So I invited her there, and we don't have time to go into all the details. But it was so romantic. And at the opportune moment, I took her hand in mine. I went down on one knee, looked up into her eye, and at that moment, it dawned on her what was about to happen. She didn't see any of this coming. True story, she took her hand out of mine. She stuck it straight out like this. And she looked me dead in the eye and said, "Don't even think of asking me to marry you." I've been hanging out with this chick for 3 years, the hope of 3 years, and that one moment died. And then she said one word that I'll forever be thankful for. Anyone want to guess what that was? She says, "Until." Man, until hope revived. Until when? What's the condition? She said, "Until you first have a relationship with your father, because I'm not going to marry anyone who has a dysfunctional relationship with either one of their parents." I thought, whoa. Not only is she hot, she's kind of smart. 16, 17, 18, 19 years of age. So I left California, I went back to West Virginia, and I really worked hard to try and manufacture this relationship with my dad to pacify her. And in all honesty, the relationship with my father never did click. Have you ever had something where the harder you tried, the harder it got? It never clicked. Now, I did get the relationship with my dad to a place where my wife was deceived enough to say, "I do." It looked good. But it never did click until about 3 years into our marriage. We got married in our 20s. 20 exactly. She was 20, I was 20. And we were seated, 23 years of age, we were seated in my father's living room. We were seated on one couch, he was seated on another. And my dad's kind of a tough guy. I mean, he's one of those kind of macho men. Very masculine. Doesn't show a lot of emotion. If he ever starts to cry, he's not crying, his eyes are sweating. Do you know that type of masculinity? Kind of unhealthy. Sorry, Dad, wherever you are. And so he's there in his usual gruff self, sitting on one couch, we're seated on another. And my wife starts to do this thing where I can see it in his body language. And if my wife were here, I would even warn you. My wife has the capacity to make people feel so loved and safe and comfortable around her that if you didn't know what you were doing, in a matter of moments upon first meeting her, you would begin to feel so comfortable, you would confess things to her about yourself that you wouldn't even tell a Catholic priest, all right? So she starts to do this with my dad, and I see his body language softening. And now the more relaxed my dad's becoming, the more stressed I'm becoming, because I've seen her do this to other people, and this time it's my dad, and I'm in the room. So where's this headed? And I gave my wife the look. You know what look I'm talking about? It's that look that no words are exchanged. It just says, "What on earth are you doing right now?" And she gave me back a look that strikes fear into the heart of every man. It's a look that says, "Oh, nothing." I knew something was coming. I didn't know what. When my father was at his most vulnerable moment, she said, "Herb, I have a question." Now, I'm a second. My father's name is Herb as well. Don't get confused. She's talking to him now. She says, "Herb, I have a question, but I don't know how to ask it." We're from West Virginia. He said, "Well, shoot, darling, just come right out and say it." So she said, "Okay, I'd like to know why you didn't visit your son more often when he was a little boy." Hello? I'm in the room. You got him all relaxed and ready for this conversation. What about me? You should have seen my dad. He looked at me, he looked at her, he looked at the floor. He looked back up at me, he looked back at her, looked back at the floor. And after what seemed like an indefinite period of silence, he looked back up at me and we locked eyes. And he said words that, to this day, I will never forget these words. He said, "Herb, I know you love your mother very much. And I would hate to do anything to come between that." He said, but when I left your mother, not you, your mother. He said, I never in my wildest imagination even conceived of the thought that I was going to be losing you. He told me of a heated and lengthy custody battle, and I was 4. But honestly, that evening, I was thinking, well, sure, there's two sides to every story. Of course, you're going to say this. Sensing my skepticism, he said, you need to see something. So he motioned for my wife and I to stand up and to follow him into his dining room. He walks into his dining room. He has this huge antique buffet. He opens up one of the drawers. He pulls out this shoebox, like a shoebox, and he lifts the lid off this shoebox. And does anyone want to guess what was inside? Some of you have read my book. That's cheating. Do you remember back before the digital age when every time you'd write a check, it would be processed and then returned to you with your monthly bank statement? How many remember those days? In this box was every child support check my father had ever written. They'd been processed in my mother's bank account, returned with his monthly statement. And I didn't take time to look at them at that moment, but I'm telling you, that box was full. Later that night, as I went through them, I noticed there was never one missing, never one late. When you looked at the amounts for which they were written, many times they were written for significantly more than what the state even required of him. But as I'm first encountering this box and I'm trying to make sense of it, what is this? All of a sudden it dawns on me what these checks communicate, the meaning of what's in this box. And in my heart, I start to wonder, could it be? And I look up into the eyes of my dad. And I saw something at that day in his face that I have never seen up to that point, and I've never seen it since. But here is my tough, masculine father, and there are tears streaming down his cheeks. As he begins to choke out for me the story of birthday presents that were sent every year and thrown away by my mother. He said, I've waited 23 years for you to see me as I am. That 4-year-old little boy stuck in a 23-year-old body. That day lost a father and gained a dad. Something shifted that day inside of me. Why am I sharing this story with you this morning? Because for me, this is the genius of Jesus. Jesus comes to us and in the story tells us we've been lied to about a heavenly parent. Not intentionally, maybe. But nonetheless, we've all been raised in a world, in a culture, in a society, in a community, and I wish I didn't have to say it, but sometimes even in religious communities, in churches, where we've been given misinformation about what's in the heart of God for us. What role God has played at different moments in our lives. We're trying to understand, but we're grasping in the darkness. And Jesus whispers in, let me tell you about not how you can get a God in your heart, but how deeply you are in the heart of God. My friend Charlie Crabill, some of you are unfamiliar with his work. He's a curator at the Marginal Mennonite Society. He writes, where did Jesus get his inspiration? From the Torah, the prophets, and the writings, of course. Little of what Jesus said was original with him. His genius was not so much in the substance of his sayings as in the way he curated his source material. He had the same Old Testament we do. The methodology that Jesus used for selecting what to highlight and what to leave on the shelf. And Jesus left a lot on the shelf. He ignored the negative qualities attributed to Yahweh. The wrath, the retribution, the jealousy, the rage, the pettiness. He also ignored Yahweh's military exploits. The occasions where God was portrayed as siding with one tribe over other tribes on the battlefield. Jesus knew intuitively that the stories of Yahweh behaving badly were projections of the humans who had written the texts. He understood that Yahweh the warrior is a literary character created by the scribes for their patriotic tales of Israel's glorious past. At the same time, Jesus resonated with Yahweh's noblest qualities. Think of everything you know about Jesus in the story. The mercy, the compassion, the generosity, forgiveness, non-judgment, etc. He scoured the scrolls for passages where God is shown in the best light. These became Jesus' favorite passages. They inspired his philosophy of conciliation, affirmation, and even pacifism. Because Jesus was confident that the God who really exists is the source of all truth and beauty in the universe. And this God is conciliatory, affirming, and non-violent. All the time. Jesus reasoned that any teachings or texts that contradict the mercy and compassion of God carried no weight in his parables. It was a radical perspective for a marginal Jew from the Galilean hinterlands, yet it is the perspective that has made Jesus such a provocative and inspirational figure for the past 2 millennia. How many are thankful for Jesus this morning? How does the nonviolent Jesus challenge you? We've spent this week talking about the nonviolent atonement. How does the nonviolent Jesus challenge what you believe, your pictures of a divine being? How does it challenge how you interpret the atonement? The atonement includes violence. How many would agree with the story's pretty violent? How does the non-violent Jesus challenge you to interpret the violence in the story? Is that really what an angry God demanded in order to be somehow satiated? How does the non-violent Jesus challenge you in how you relate to others? For we will always relate to others in the way that we perceive there is a divine being relating to us. I'm thankful too this morning for Jesus. Amen. And I don't want to make following Jesus hard, but I do want to be honest where following Jesus is hard. The nonviolent Jesus challenges some of our most deeply cherished and deeply held beliefs. I'm thankful this morning for a Jesus who's whispering to us that we have a divine parent that is nothing like we've been told. God is love.